been told everything else.
Yeah, I just didn't like that word. I said, I ain't chronic. But we look up chronic, and it says if you do it more than once, you're chronic. So I was chronic be more than once. Okay. That applies to things other than alcohol, too. Okay. Another word in there, phenomenon. Phenomenon, that word means something that we know occurs that is unexplainable to us. But we know that it happens. We see it happens, but it's unexplainable. It's limited to this class and never carries the average tramp or drinker. Normal people do not crave alcohol. And, I've really gotten into this in the last few years. I have come, one of my great pastimes is on the airplanes is watching normal social drinkers. Now, if you watch enough normal social drinkers, then you will know that you are abnormal. Now, they get a drink, and I watch them, they give them a little ridiculous bottle. It ain't enough to start. It's an ounce. Most of that gets wasted on the insides of the bottle. Then they pour that over in there, and they got little sticks. I don't know. They give them some sticks. And they stir a lot. I don't know what they do that for. And then after they get it stirred up, like I said, they put it down and read their magazines. And talk. And they'll pick it up and just let it slide, set it back down real quick. Sometimes, they'll have to let them throw it out. Can you imagine? That's normal. See? I had one call the attendant back, stewardess back one day. I said, "You gonna get another drink?" You know what he said? "Give me some peanuts." Now, what do you need peanuts? What does peanuts have to do with drinking? Okay, now that's normal. Now,
I saw one up one day that took his little bottle and he poured half of it in that drink and put the cap on and put it in his coat pocket. Yeah, that bugged me so damn bad. After a while, I had to say, "What are you going to do with the rest of that?"
He honestly did.
He said, "I'm going to take it home and have another drink whenever you want." If you see enough of that, then you realize that you are abnormal when it comes to alcohol.
He says, "These allergy types can never safely use alcohol in any form at all. And once having formed their habit of found it can break it. Once having lost their self-confidence, their reliance upon things human, their problems pile up upon them, they become astonishingly difficult to solve."
So I think it's easy to see that the manifestation of the allergy to alcohol is different than what I thought it was. So you don't necessarily break out in a rash. You don't necessarily have the dysentery or the itchy, watery, sneezy eyes and nose. The manifestation of the allergy to alcohol is the phenomenon of craving, the physical craving that demands that we have more of the same. That's the major difference between us and the normal social drinker. Now, if we'll go over one more page, he's going to talk about five different kinds of alcoholics, and then he's going to use that to make a point. Joe?
Okay. He says the classification of alcoholics seems most difficult, and as much detail as outside the scope of this book. We're not going to talk about all of them. There are, of course, the psychopaths who are emotionally unstable. We are familiar with this type. They are always going on a wagon for keeps. They are over-remorseful and make many resolutions, but never a decision.
That's type one.
There is a type of man who is unwilling to admit that he cannot take a drink. He plans various ways of drinking. He changes his brand or his environment.
That's type two.
There is a type who always believes that to be entirely free from alcohol for a period of time, he can take a drink without danger.
That's type three.
There is a manic depressive type who is perhaps the least understood by his friends, and about whom a whole chapter could be written.
Type four. Now, next one, type five. I always thought fit me just perfect.
Okay. Then there are our types entirely normal in every respect, except the effect alcohol has upon them. They are often able, intelligent, friendly people.
I used to read that and I'd think, how in the hell did he know so much about me? Now then he says, all these and many others have one symptom in common. They cannot start drinking without developing the phenomenon of craving. Now, I think what he's really saying to you and I is this. If all of we alcoholics in this room tonight should take a drink, God forbid that happen, but if we did, we would not all act exactly the same. You know, one of us would get over in a corner and start crying in her beer, oh, boo-hoo-hoo-hoo, the world's not treating me right. Another one would get right out in the middle of the floor, get up on the table, hooping, hollering, dancing, just having a hell of a great time. Within 30 minutes, two of us would be over in the corner, we'd be in a fight, just sure as anything. At the same time, there'll be two more in the other corner, and we'll be putting the make on each other. We tend to do that when we drink also. Now, we would not all do exactly the same thing, but there is one thing we would all do. As soon as we had that drink, we would start looking for a second drink, and a third drink, and a fourth drink, and a fifth drink, and a sixth drink, and on till we're drunk, sick, and in all kinds of trouble. I know that's true, because if that wasn't true, we wouldn't be sitting in this room tonight. If we could drink without getting drunk, we'd be out there somewhere drinking. And the only reason we're here is because we learned that we could not drink alcohol, nor could we stay sober and not drink alcohol left on our own resources. And it really doesn't make any difference. Whether we were that way in the beginning, I was. First drink I ever took, I got drunk. Never did I have one drink of anything with alcohol in it in 26 years of drinking. Some of you might have had a year, 2 years, 5, 10, 15, or even 20 of relatively safe drinking. But somewhere you crossed a line. And every time you start drinking, you start getting in trouble. So it doesn't make any difference whether it occurred when we were 14 or whether it occurred when we're 40. We've reached the same point. That's why we're sitting here tonight. And it doesn't make any difference how long it takes us to get drunk. Some of us, the allergy is so pronounced that we simply cannot take a drink without getting drunk immediately. If I'd take a drink now, about 9:30, by midnight, I've found a cop and I'm in jail somehow. Some of you may have one or two tonight, three or four tomorrow night, five or six the next night, and it may take you a week or 2 weeks to get back to a fifth a day or whatever it was you used to drink. But it really doesn't make any difference whether it takes an hour, a day, or a week for us to get drunk. The drink we take tonight is what sets it off. That's the thing we have in common in AA. Too many times we sit around and we listen for things that we can't identify with. He says he's been in jail 27 times. I say, I'm not like him. I've just been there 3 times. Or she says, I've had 5 husbands. And I say, I'm not like her, just 3 wives for me. But if we will all listen, I don't care whether we're black, white, male, female, old, young, Protestant, Catholic, doesn't make a bit of difference. There's one thing that we have in common, the phenomenon of craving that develops after we have one, two, or three drinks. Now, craving, in the context of the big book, is always dealing with this physical factor. Craving has nothing to do with the mind in the big book. Now, people come to AA and they say, oh, I craved alcohol for a year after I... No, they didn't crave alcohol. They had an obsession with the mind to drink it. Well, they desired alcohol. In the context of the big book, the word craving always refers to the phenomenon of craving that occurs physically within the body after we've had one, two, or three drinks. Joe?
Okay.
Do it. Thank you.
Yeah.
Ready? Ready for this?
Yeah, I'll do it.
I'll just finish.
Okay.
Yeah. You want to go to the board?
Okay, yeah.
Have a little consultation. You have in your handout sheets a thing called the disease concept of alcoholism. Briefly, we would like to go through that with you. And the first statement we're going to make is this information is not AA information. AA doesn't care. PA is not about to get involved in any controversy as to why we're allergic. But the medical profession in the last few years has come up with some information that absolutely proves the doctor's opinion. Now, back in the 30s, they knew very little about this thing called metabolism. They didn't know that necessarily that when you take something like a piece of beefsteak and put it in your system, that certain enzymes attack that beefsteak. The enzymes break it down into usable and non-usable items. And the body can extract from it the things like proteins, amino acids, vitamins. What it can't use, it can dissipate through the urinary and the intestinal tract. They didn't know much about that in those days. Today they do. They know that when you and I take anything into our body, the body has the ability to recognize what it is, produce a certain enzymes, metabolize it, extract what it can, and dissipate the rest. Now, the body can do that with anything unless it's something like a deadly poison. A deadly poison can overcome the body's ability so rapidly that the body can't get it metabolized in time. Let's see what it does with alcohol. In the center of this picture, the center line talks about nine who drink safely. They are at ease with alcohol. This is a normal, social, temperate, moderate drinker. Alcohol is no problem for them. They take a drink, put it in the system. The mind and the body recognize what it is. The enzyme production starts. The enzymes attack the alcohol and break it down first to a material called acetaldehyde. Then after a period of time to diacetic acid. And then after a period of time to acetone. Then, in the final stages, it goes from acetone to a simple carbohydrate, which is made up of water, sugar, and carbon dioxide. The sugar is energy, calories, empty calories, no amino acids, none of the vitamins necessary for life, but it's a form of energy. The body can burn it, and it will store the excess as fat. The water will be dissipated through the urinary and the intestinal tract. The carbon dioxide will be dissipated through the lungs. In the normal, social, moderate, temperate drinker, the average rate of metabolism is 1 ounce per hour. Now, I know that'll vary sometimes with the condition of the body and the size and etc., but the average is 1 ounce per hour. If the normal, social, temperate, moderate drinker never drinks more than 1 ounce per hour, they can't get drunk. And very seldom will they ever drink any more than that, because if they do, they get a slightly tipsy, out-of-control, nauseous feeling. Get the hell out of the way. They're going to puke all over you in just a little bit. See? Now let's take the one on the left-hand column. This is the one who is at dis-ease with alcohol. And that's all the word disease means, something that separates you from the norm. We alcoholics take a drink, put it in our system. Same thing happens. The body and the mind senses what it is. The enzyme production starts. Enzymes attack the alcohol, break it down first to material called acetaldehyde. Then after a period of time, the diacetic acid. Then to acetone. But it seems as though in the body of the alcoholic, the enzymes necessary to break it from acetone to the simple carbohydrate are not there in the same qualities and quantities as they are in the non-alcoholic. Therefore, the breakdown rate from acetone to the simple carbohydrate occurs at a much slower rate of time. Maybe the body alcoholic is only capable of metabolizing 3/4 of an ounce per hour, 1/2 ounce per hour, 1/4 ounce per hour, 1/10 ounce per hour. It will differ with different alcoholics. The intensity of the allergy is different between us. Now, it's a well-known medical fact today that acetone ingested into the human system that remains there for an appreciable length of time will develop an actual physical craving for more of the same. And before we can get it metabolized out, the physical craving becomes so strong that the body demands more of what we've just put in it. That thing that the normal social drinker tries to vomit up, our body demands more of it because of the acetone. Now, I think one of the most interesting things we can look at today is not only do we have a disease, but we have a progressive disease. And we think it's progressive for two reasons. Number one, acetone is also a destroyer of human tissue. And over an appreciable period of time, as we drink, we begin to destroy human tissue, and it seems as though the first two things that we normally begin to destroy happen to be the liver and the pancreas. Today they've proven that the enzymes necessary to metabolize alcohol comes from the liver and the pancreas. So as we drink and time goes by, the enzyme production becomes less and less and less due to the damage to the liver and the pancreas. Therefore, when the enzyme production becomes less, the craving becomes harder. We also know that as we grow older, practically everything that the body produces begins to shut down. You know, I wish that was not true, but it is. And these enzymes necessary to metabolize alcohol, they will become less and less and less as time goes by due to the aging factor. Now, I haven't had a drink in 18 years, but if I'd take a drink today, I would not start where I left off 18 years ago. My craving would be much harder today because the enzyme production is less than it was 18 years ago. So for two reasons, we are in the grips of a progressive disease. Now let's you and I take one of our little drinking sprees just to kind of illustrate what we're talking about. Let's say that we're working and it's hot summertime. And I've been promising the wife that I'd mow the grass. Damn grass is about knee deep. And she raised hell about it this morning, and I said, okay, don't worry, I'll cut it when I get home tonight. So I go work all day, and I'm tired, and I start home from work, and I say to myself, you know, by God, if I'd stop at the bar and have a drink, I could cut that grass a hell of a lot better. One drink. Now, that's probably true. With one drink, I could probably cut the grass better. So I stop in the bar, I order a drink, I'm sitting there visiting with a guy on the stool next to me, and I begin to drink that drink down. Now, almost immediately when that stuff hits my system, and this craving begins to develop due to the acetone, and I'm sitting there and I'm drinking my drink and I put it in my body, and I say in my mind, I say, I've got to get up and go on home now and cut the grass. Well, the craving has been produced in the body, and the body said, well, now wait just a minute. It said, listen, we could do a better job with two drinks. Let's have one more drink and then we'll go. So the mind says, okay. And the mind orders a drink. The drink comes. And we pick that drink up and we put it in our system. Now we've got most of the acetone in there from the first drink. We now have all the acetone from the second drink. And as the acetone level goes up, the craving becomes harder. And the mind says, boy, I need to get up and go home and cut the grass. And the body said, told you a while ago not to be in too big a hurry. I think we ought to have one more of them before we go. So the mind says, okay, we order a third drink. We got most of the first, all of the second, and now we put the third drink in. The acetone level goes up higher yet. And the craving becomes harder. And the mind says, damn, I've got to go cut the grass. And the body said, I told you a while ago not to be in any hurry. Let's have one more, and then we'll go. So the mind says, okay, we order another drink. We put it in our system. We got most of the first, almost all of the second and third, and now we've laid the fourth in there. The acetone level goes up, and the craving becomes harder. And the mind said, if I don't cut that grass, I'm going to be in a hell of a shape. And the body says, forget the goddamn grass. We'll cut it next week. This is the physical allergy to alcohol. Now, so far as medical science knows today, anybody that's ever developed this has never been cured of it. And all medical science can tell us is that if you're allergic to that, then don't drink it. And you know, that's really all I've got to do. If I want to take care of my alcoholism, is don't drink alcohol. As long as I don't put it in there, then I cannot produce the phenomenon of craving. And I won't end up drunk and sick and in all kinds of trouble. But there's something else wrong with me, too. My mind seems to keep telling me that it's okay to drink. That may be obvious to everybody else that I can't drink safely, but my mind, from time to time, believes that I can. You know, I've got a friend who is allergic to, of all things, fish. And every time he eats fish, his throat swells up. He almost chokes to death, and they put him right back in the hospital. Now, the fact that he's allergic to fish is really beside the point. Because his allergy could not hurt him if he did not eat the fish. But that sucker's got another problem, too. His mind keeps telling him that it's okay to eat fish. And I'll bet you it always starts like this. It says, I haven't had any fish in 90 days. Surely I could eat one piece of fish. Or it may say, it's some damn crappie I've been eating. If I'd eat nothing but pure bass, it'd be all right. Or probably it says, it's some damn people I've been eating fish with. You know? So let's look for a moment now at the second half of our disease. We can see why we can't drink safely. Now let's look and see why we can't keep from drinking.
Okay, we'll back up a page again. And it begins with the explanation. He says, men and women drink essentially because they like the effects produced by alcohol.
Now, many people today, when you tell them that, they're highly offended. They say, no, that isn't why I drank. They say, I drink alcohol because I love the taste of it. Well, I wouldn't argue with anybody whether they love the taste of it or not. I love the taste of cold beer, always have all my life. But I also love the taste of cold mountain spring water. And I never did sit down and drink a case of cold mountain spring water. How many times have I walked out to my car when it's sitting in the sun in the summertime, probably 130, 40 degrees in the trunk, reach in there and get out a bottle of vodka, take the cap off of it, and take a big snort of that vodka and say, oh, God almighty, oh, shit. Ain't it good? Nothing can taste any more horrible than that. I drank it because I knew that if it stayed down there, magical things would begin to happen very rapidly. I knew that my fears, my anxieties, my worries, my inability to communicate with people, my inability to ask girls for dates and to dance with them, I knew those would all disappear if I could get that alcohol down there and it'd stay down there. You know, as a kid growing up, I was always on the outside of the crowd looking in. Never could be what I wanted to be. Always knew that whatever I did would be wrong. One night somebody gave me a drink of alcohol, and I took it, and all those fears disappeared. And I was allowed that night to ask a girl to dance with me, allowed to ask her to take her home, allowed to get her in the back seat of a 36 Chevrolet and do some of the things that I'd been wanting to do, but I was afraid to do them. Now, I loved what alcohol did for me. And the next day I woke up sick. But my mind did not dwell on how bad I felt. It dwelled on what alcohol did for me the night before. And I became immediately obsessed with the idea of drinking alcohol to change the way that I feel. Men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. Jim?
The sensation is so elusive. That while they admit it is innocent, they cannot after a time differentiate the truth from the false. To them, their alcoholic life seems the only normal one. Says they are restless, irritable, and discontented. Unless they can again experience the sense of ease and comfort, which comes at once by taking a few drinks, drinks that they see others taking with impunity. After they have succumbed to desire again, as so many do, and the phenomenon of craving develops, they pass through the well-known stage of the spree, emerging remorse for the firm resolution not to drink again, This is repeated over and over. Unless this person can experience an entire psychic change, there is very little hope of his recovery. Now, this is the way he says that before we drink, we are restless, irritable, and discontent. And once we feel this pain, when we realize the pain, then we think about a solution that we used before, a sense of ease and comfort that we're going to get out of a few drinks, drinks that are not bothering other people. And we take these few drinks, and then they set off the craving in the body, and we go through the well-known spree.
Is there enough cord here? He can look that cord.
Okay, and then with the mental side, he says we become restless, miserable, and discontent. And this is the main problem of the alcoholic. My book is going to talk about this. The main problem of the alcoholic centers in his mind, although this is half and half, but I like to look at this as more important because this is where all the work is going to be done. Because as we said, if you're allergic to alcohol, if you don't drink, you'll never have any problems with it. I always like to associate that with another problem I got all my life. I can't drink. I never was able to drink. The only thing I worked at got worse. But I never learned how to swim. There's two things I can't do. I can't drink, and I can't swim either. And my brother, when we were kids, the buddy in the swimming pool in our neighborhood. Not in those days. So we would go to the swimming hole, and he never would. He was 3 years older than I was, and he wouldn't carry me because he knew I would tell on him. See, and he would get in trouble. So he would take the other kids, but he learned to swim, and I didn't. So I can't swim. There's two things. I can't drink either. Now I can't swim. Both of them not just as well as one as the other. But mentally, I never had an obsession to jump in the water. See what I mean? You know, there's a lot different, you know, if you... But over here, I had an obsession to do something that I couldn't do. This is the main problem, you know. I don't have any trouble with swimming as long as I don't jump in the water. Now, over here, he explains this obsession. He says we are restless and irritable and discontent. And every person has an emotional life, and everybody has an emotional problem. Not just we alcoholics. All people have emotions, and all people have problems with their emotions. No one is immune from this. Any individual, and they act today, cause all kind of problems. In fact, Bill said most human problems are born right in here. Misdirected instincts. Everybody has problems with their instincts. They build on up on us. They become restless, irritable, and discontent. And they produce pain or discomfort. As Charlie said, we feel inadequate. I feel lonely. I fear inadequate feelings. And they build up on us. They become a problem. Somewhere, and we may experience this for a period of time, but finally, it happens that while experiencing this restless, irritable, and discontent, while uncomfortable, we are introduced to alcohol, or we notice that we have a few drinks. And we take these few drinks. The few drinks come back over here and depress our emotions, and alcohol is a downer in the drug world. And as the end result, we have a sense of ease and comfort that comes at once by taking a few drinks. Now, once we take these few drinks and we get the relief, then the few drinks become a solution in our minds. We remember, the doctor says we remember that. And the next time we build up to this point, we remember the solution. And we simply add those things together, addition. That's our addiction. In the mind, that's all it is. You know, we are remembering success. And this is not anything that's unique to the alcoholic or to a drug addict. I hear people say they are addicts. But really, all people are addicts. All people remember success. You know, say if a person here today, if his TV was broke, and he didn't know anyone could fix it in town. He would go around and go in the Yellow Pages and call somebody. If he was new here in town, but if he was here, I'll probably dial. But he would find someone to come over to fix his TV, and he would add that together, really. The next time his TV was broke, he wouldn't go into the Yellow Pages. He would remember the man that fixed it the last time. He would use what worked before. You know, we buy the same type of products. We go to the same barbershop. We go to the same store. We buy this. We repeat success. And it's usually, it's a part of human life. It's a part of every personality to use that. And to use it in most cases is good, unless we use it on something like alcohol or drugs. And then it's a part of our life that becomes, that works against us. So we become restless and irritable and discontent. We build up to this point. We trigger this line, and this is obsession. Obsession is an idea. The only way you can take a drink, the only way you can take a drink is have an idea to drink. An obsession is an idea that overcomes all other ideas once it's triggered. The idea to drink will overcome all other ideas. You know, sometimes we go to the hospital and we go through a bad thing, or we go to the hospital or in the detox center and we see somebody almost die, and you say, boy, I'll never take another drink after seeing that. And that seemed like that should work. That's a strong idea. But when the idea to drink comes up, it will push that idea out of the way. And it will say drink. It will overcome all other ideas. And all action is born in thought. So you cannot take a drink unless you're preceded by the thought to drink. So it builds up to this point, we trigger the obsession to drink, we reach over, take a few drinks. Now, as soon as the alcohol hits the system, then it becomes a physical problem. Now, the alcohol comes over here, at that point it becomes physical, it triggers the acetones, which triggers the phenomenal craving, And the craving produces more drinking. Now we're drinking because of the physical craving. And we drink and go through the well-known spree, and we emerge remorseful with a firm resolution not to drink again. And after we get through drinking and get sick and get in trouble, every alcoholic repeats his national anthem, I will never do that again. And after you get in trouble, you really mean that. And then we slowly start another build-up. And what causes us to build up is everyday living. Going to work, you know, stopping for gas, you know, going to the grocery store, just doing everyday things. Things that we can't escape from and start us to build up again. And once we reach our tolerance point, which is unique with each person, this build-up is unique. This is why we're going to take a four-step and look at what causes us individually to drink, because no two of us are the same. But once we reach our tolerance level, it triggers the obsession to drink, and this triggers doctor said this is repeated over and over again. And that's a vicious cycle because the mind is triggering the body, and the body in reverse is triggering the mind, because the more the mind makes us put alcohol in the system, the chemical deficiency gets worse with time. And as the chemical deficiency gets worse, the craving gets harder. And as the craving gets harder, the drinking gets harder. And as the drinking gets harder, more problems we create over here to re-trigger it back again. So it's a self-destructive force of the mind destroying the body, and the body in reverse destroying the mind. As we said, if we have this problem on this side, is we sum this up, if we have a physical allergy, we cannot safely drink alcohol. Now, over here, because of the mind, if we have started this little game of building up and taking a few drinks to relieve it, then if we have this mental obsession, the problem on this side is we can't quit drinking. We can't drink because of the body, and we can't quit because of the mind. You know, I've looked at this a little different every once in a while. I looked at
I used to say, well, yes, I could quit because I quit 3 times one day. I think my problem was I couldn't stop starting. You know, I could. But I can't drink because of the body. If you can't drink, if you have the physical allergy, you can't drink safely. And if you got the mental obsession on your own, you can't quit. And so what we're talking about in the first step is tying these two things together. If you can't drink because of the body and can't quit because of the mind, then you are powerless. Over alcohol. You are powerless over alcohol. This is the sum total of what is the problem. Now, once we see the problem, then we can determine the solution. We know there's nothing we can do about this. But we believe that the solution is in the mind, not the body. You know, for many, many years, I didn't understand my problem like many alcoholics somewhere tonight, and I thank God for Alcoholics Anonymous, Dr. Silkworth, that I was shown this. And for many, many years, I tried to control my drinking while drinking. I don't know if any of y'all did that. And I realize now because of the craving, I couldn't. You know, I realized why. And then after many, many years of drinking, I finally decided, well, you know, one month, I don't believe you can drink. You know? I was, you know, the last 2 years I've worked on this side. I tried to drink for 13 or 14 years, and then I wasted 2 or 3 years over here before I come to Alcoholics Anonymous. Well, if you can't drink, what do you do? Quit. When an alcoholic gets ready to quit, he gets his best weapon. He's, you know, we got a lot of one thing. When the alcoholic makes his mind up to quit, he means it. He gets, if you've got as much trouble. Much trouble as I got here, you'd mean it too. And when he means it, he gets Will out. Now, when he gets Will out, he means business. So I got old Will, and I put him right in there. I say, get him, Will. And I put Will in there, and I was still restless and I'm discontent. And I had an obsession to drink. They came at me constantly. But I blocked them with Will. And finally one of them little devils got through and I was gone again. We cannot be, you know, you can't really do that with Will part. But, you know, what we're talking about, once we understand the problem, I love that statement. It's, you know, such things are said so simple. I heard a guy, I was thinking it was some guy who wrote that during the you know, it had little boxes around in the war planks doing it. I don't know if any of y'all remember WW2. And they had these things around and you put little things in the box. And the guy put that in the box. And he got an award for that in the plank. He says, we find that the solution is simple once we understand the problem. And as it is, you know, if you can make some personality changes right in here, sufficient, just a few. If you can make some adjustments or rearrangements, and if you can live below this line here, you will never trigger the obsession. And you will never take the first few drinks. If you don't ever take the first few drinks, you will never set off the allergy of the body. So this is what we're talking about. Come to believe that a power greater than ourselves can restore us to sanity. Our personality changes sufficient to recover from alcoholism.
What this thing is really saying is that if we could find a way to live and be sober and not be restless and irritable and discontented, but be filled with some peace of mind and serenity and happiness, that it won't be necessary to take a drink in order to change the way that we feel. And it seems as though the only way we can do that is through changes in the mind itself. Now, you know, this is not anything brand new. This has been going on in humankind for centuries. And there's all kinds of people that's got all kinds of problems. And many people have obsessions of the mind about different things. They cannot always see the truth about that.
You know, we have a group of people today that are called Overeaters Anonymous. And they have an obsession of the mind to eat certain foods. And apparently the food does for them about the same thing a drink does for us. They get an immediate sense of ease and comfort, which comes from eating that particular food. And they eat it, and they eat it, and they eat it, and they literally destroy themselves and everybody around them. Because their mind refuses from time to time to recognize the truth. And what they're really doing is changing the way they feel by the food that they eat. Now, if they can find a way to live where they can be free from that particular food, whatever it is, and not be restless, irritable, and discontented, then they won't need to eat that food to change the way they feel either. I know this is true because they use the same identical 12-step program that you and I use to overcome our obsession of the mind dealing with alcohol. There's a group of people in the world today called Gamblers Anonymous. And when you really talk to one of these real gamblers, they tell me that's not one of the most exciting things that they can possibly do. And they get a feeling not only in the mind but also in the body, that only gambling produces for them. And that feeling is so great that their mind has become obsessed with the idea of gambling. And they literally destroy themselves and the lives of everybody around them. And if they could find a way to live where they could be free from gambling and peaceful and happy and serene and not need the gambler in order to change the way they feel, then they can recover too. I know this is true, because they use the same 12-step program. We have a group of people in the world today who are obsessed with the idea of all things of stopping other people from drinking. And they do everything in the world they can do to stop them from drinking. And I really don't know what it is they get out of it, but they get something out of it. And if they find something that works one time, then their mind becomes obsessed with the idea of doing that again. And they try over and over and over. And it's obvious it doesn't work. But they believe that it will. And it literally destroys their lives and the lives of everybody around them. If they could find a way to live and be peaceful and happy and free and serene, then they wouldn't need to try to stop somebody else from drinking in order to feel better themselves. I know that must be true, because Al-Anon uses the same 12 steps to overcome an obsession of the mind, just like we have. So we're not talking about anything that's brand new. We're talking about a certain set of principles, spiritual in nature, which if practiced will overcome the obsession of the mind of anybody, whatever that obsession might be. I think that's all we'll do tonight, and we'll start back in the morning now that we've seen the problem. We'll start looking at the solution. But I think before we quit, I want to tell one joke. I've been dying to tell it all evening, and Joe just loves it. And we're really not male chauvinists, but this particular joke is about a lady, and she was unhappy with the size of her breast, and she wanted them to be larger. So she went to this special doctor called Dr. Vanderpool, and that's what he specialized in. And the doctor said, "Oh, yeah, we can help you." He said, "There's several ways we can do that with surgery. We can use an implant procedure and several different kinds of implants," but he said, "That's very painful, and it's quite expensive." He says, "Really, in the last 2-3 years, we've developed an exercise that if you'll use it faithfully, that it'll do the same job, and it's not very painful, and doesn't cost any money." She said, "Oh, doctor, that would be great. What is it?" He said, "Well, the way you do this is," now I'm going to have to stand up to finish it up. He said, "You, every morning at 8 o'clock, and every afternoon at 4 o'clock, he said, you put your feet together, you put your arms out to the side, and you say, 'Mary had a little lamb, it fleece was white as snow. And everywhere that Mary went, that lamb was sure to go.' He said, if you'll do that every morning at 8 o'clock, 4 o'clock, every day, don't miss,
over a period of time, it really will work. And she said, oh, doctor, that's right. And she went home and she began to practice her exercise. And one day while traveling, she was going through an airport. She was walking through the lobby, had her bags in hand. She had to look up, and there was the clock, and it said 4 o'clock in the afternoon. She said, oh, my God, do I dare do it here? And she said to herself, well, they don't know me. They wouldn't know what I'm doing, so it wouldn't make any difference. She sets her bags down. She puts her feet together. She puts her arms out. She said, Mary had a little lamb at least as wide as snow. And everywhere that Mary went, that lamb was sure to go. And there was a fellow standing over against the wall watching her. He walked up to her and he said, lady, do you happen to know a Dr. Vanderpool? And she said, yes, I do. How do you know him? And he said, Hickory, Hickory.
Joyce, do you want to close?
I'm about to decide to take her home with me if she'll keep saying that. My name is Charlie Farman. I'm a very grateful recovering alcoholic. Because I'm a member of the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. And by the grace of the power that I found in the 12-step program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I haven't found it necessary to take a drink for 6,576 days today, one day at a time. And for this, I'm very grateful. Isn't it nice to be up and at 'em and alive on Saturday morning and know where we are and know where we were last night? I woke up this morning and I even knew who was in the bed on the other side of the room. I looked over there and there was old Joe, just like always. And I'd been hearing a little noise, kind of a whispering thing going on for quite some time. I think that's what woke me up. And when I looked over there, he was really standing in the corner doing hickory dickory dock. He was just kind of whispering it, though, as he did. Last night by the way, my cold is better this morning. I think maybe I'm going to make it today. I hope so. Last night we talked about, in the doctor's opinion, this thing called the disease of alcoholism. We talked about the physical allergy of the body, the thing that separates us from normal people, which is manifested by the phenomenon of craving that occurs after we've had 1, 2, or 3 drinks. And that, of course, was the physical side of our disease. And we could see that's why we can't drink safely. Then we talked about the obsession of the mind and the reason we drink. And the book said that men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. And it said the sensation is so elusive that after a while we really cannot differentiate the true from the false. Well, that's what an obsession is, an idea that is so strong that it makes us believe something that is not true. And just before we drink, our mind tells us that we can drink. And it tells us it's going to be okay. This time it's going to be different, and etc. So we could see that because of that obsession of the mind, we can't stay sober. And if we can't drink and if we can't stay sober, then we have become absolutely powerless over alcohol. And if we've become powerless over alcohol and we don't do something about it, then sooner or later, certainly our life will become unmanageable. There's not any doubt about that at all. Now, this morning we're going to look at Bill's story. And I think Bill's story fits in here in a very unique way in the big book. Number one, I think what it does is put in there for the purpose of identification. You know, back in the 30s when they were writing the big book and when it was published in 1939, the first person down here in Texas to read the big book would not be able to talk to Bill and Bob and this first 100 on a personal basis. Well, that's the way we 12-step today, and the way they 12-stepped then, when it was possible, they'd go out and sit down with a new alcoholic and tell their story. And by the telling of their story, they could help the new alcoholic see what their problem is. And they would talk about how they recovered, and they could help the new alcoholic see what they needed to recover. But if you couldn't see them on a personal basis, you couldn't tell your story. So Bill's story was put here in the book, just where it is, so that the first person down here in Texas in reading this thing would be able to identify with Bill Wilson. Bill's story is the classic 12-step call here in the front of the book. Also, it's going to start a trend that we'll see all the way through the book. It never tells us something, but what it doesn't turn right around and reinforce that with an example. Now, we've already seen the disease in the doctor's opinion. Bill's story is going to be an example of a person who had that disease. And we're going to be able to see the progression in his life. We're going to be able to see the hopeless condition of the mind and the body. We're going to be able to see the unmanageability of his life. And then we're going to be able to see him affect a recovery from that disease. So not only does it give me an example and helps me identify, but it probably is the beginning of belief and hope. You know, when I was drinking so heavily before AA, I assumed that that was just what I was going to do the rest of my life. I figured I would drink until I died from the disease. But in Bill's story, I saw another alcoholic recover. And for the first time, I could begin to believe that maybe, just maybe, something can be done about this problem that I've got with alcohol. And I began to believe that there might be some way to recover. So Bill's story does two or three things, and it sets in here just exactly where it should be in reference to the textbook theory. Joe?
My name is Joe, and I'm a real alcoholic. Good God's grace, because this program works, I haven't found it necessary to take a drink today, but this I'm extremely grateful. As Charlie says, Bill's story is a classic example of the progression of the disease of alcoholism. We can see how it began, and we can see it, you know, it began to grow in his life. And once we learn alcoholism, then this gives us a complete explanation of it. We begin on page 2, and he said, I took a night law course and obtained employment in an investigator for a surety company. The drive for success was on. Now, we can already identify with Bill. Most of us, you know, have always, somewhere in our lives, we were at that point. We had that's that self-will. I proved to the world that I was important. My work took me about Wall Street. And little by little, I became interested in the market. You know, this week, we ought to be particularly able to identify with that. Many people lost money, but some became rich. Why not I? You know, typical alcoholic. You see, I studied economics and business as well as law. Potential alcoholic that I was, I nearly failed my law course. At one of the finals, I was too drunk to think all right. You know, we can see all the seeds of really the problem here already. Though my drinking was not yet continuously disturbed my wife. We had long talks when I was still her foreboding by telling her that men of genius conceive their best projects when drunk. Typical alcoholic already. But this guy, you know, he had ideas, you know, how we switch around. He had ideas to study law and economics. But we can see already that he has gotten into Wall Street and the glitter. And he says, by the time I completed the course, he had finished the law course, I knew the law was not for me. I mean, that's too dull. You know, I got over this drinking life of this fun, and that's what I want to do. I don't want to be bothered with law. I want to get into something else. The inviting maelstrom of Wall Street had me in its grips. So I was caught up into this thing. Business and financial leaders were my heroes. You know, he saw another way of life. Out of this alloy to drink and speculation, I commenced to forge a weapon that would one day turn into flight like a boomerang and cut me to ribbons. He said, living modestly, my wife and I saved $1,000. It went into certain securities, then cheap and rather unpopular. I rightly imagined that I would someday have a great rise. I failed to persuade my broker friends to send me out looking over for factories and managers, but my wife and I decided to go anyway. And this is a little brief, you know, we don't really see what he's doing.
Bill got into this, and then he began to, you know, in this day, this was before the first crash in the stock market. The stock market was on a boom. It was really unregulated at that time. It didn't have the regulations that we have now. It was wild. Everybody was putting a bunch of money in. Everybody was making money. It didn't take up, the stocks were going up. All you had to do was put money in it and wait and then sell and to go on. It's like we was doing here recently. Okay. There were no people in that particular time. You can't imagine the financial world, but there were nobody's in. At that time, they were investigating and looking into companies. They were just betting. They just really didn't know the knowledge of the company. Today, we have plenty of people in that field that do that. And Bill was probably, as Charlie and I, he was probably the first person that come up with the idea of investigating our financial, and he was the first financial advisor in investments. Because in those days, that field didn't exist. They just threw money in. And Bill said, well, I think we ought to quit doing that and we ought to go around and investigate these companies and see their potential and invest on that basic of that information. So he went to the people that had the money and he told them, he said, hey, I got this idea. Why don't we look at these, let me go around? And he said, oh, we're making plenty of money. We don't need that. And they didn't agree with Bill. So Bill said, we decided to go anyway. So we know the story as the story went. Bill left his position. He and Lois took what little money they had and put into this project. And they got a motorcycle. And they spent a year traveling the whole eastern part of the United States, a whole year. And Bill would visit one of the largest companies. One of the companies was General Electric. He went to all the great corporations, got into them, investigated them, saw what they had on the board to develop, saw where the companies were, invested in those companies, and wrote out great reports on every company. And when he brought this back to the people who had the money and who was doing investment, and they looked at it, they were very impressed. They said, oh, this is what you're talking about. Hey man, this is a good idea. Now, nobody today would think about investing in unless they had that information. But in those days, they didn't do it. So, you know, this is where Bill, after he did this, he said on page 3, we covered the eastern part of the United States at the end of the year. My reports procured me a position that was used of a large expense account. The exercise of the option brought in more money than even with the profit of several thousand dollars for that year. Okay, now after he did that, he said, for the next few years, fortune threw money and applause my way, I had a ride. He said, my judgment is, you know, he was in a position of power, you know what I mean? He said, my judgment and ideas were followed by many to the tune of paper millions. People made paper millions. They made money off of this guy. Because he had come up with something that's a whole new industry. The great boom of the late 20s was seizing, selling, swelling. Drink was taking an important and exhilarating part in my life. There was loud talking in jazz places uptown. Everybody spending thousands, charity millions. Scoffers would scoff and be damned. I made a host of forever other friends. That's one thing about an alcoholic is typically. Usually we find that in most cases, in the case of an alcoholism, his alcoholism progressed just ahead of his success. I mean, they seem to go along about this at the same time. He said, my drinking assumed more serious proportions, continuing all day and almost every night. The remarkableness of my friends terminated in a round. I became a lone wolf. You know, Bill began to, his drinking was so bad, he began to separate from people and he'd go off by himself to do his thing. So you know we can see that it's progressing here. Okay, now, over on page 4, in October 1929, hell broke loose on the New York Stock Exchange. Okay, this was a crash. After one of those days at the Inferno, I wobbled from a hotel bar to a brokerage office. It was 8 o'clock. It was 8 o'clock, 5 hours after the market closed. The ticker still clattered. I was staring at an inch of tape which bore the inscription XYZ32. It had been 52 that morning. He said, I was finished, and so were my many friends. The paper reported men jumping to death from towers of high finance. That disgusted me. I would not jump. I went back to the bar. Yeah. Now, every alcoholic can identify with that. We might have been lost money in the stock market, but we have all been involved in something, you know, a divorce or something, or get caught fired from a job and walked out in the bar and got a few drinks and said, to hell with them, I'll deal with this. Okay. Now, he went on and things got progressively worse, and he lost his other job. And then he said he went to live. My wife's parents and found a job. Then lost it, which was also the brawl with a taxi driver. Mercifully, no one would guess that I would have to employment for 5 years at Hardy's or sober breath. My wife began to work at an department store, coming home exhausted to find me drunk. I became an unwelcome hanger-on in the brokerage places. Now, here was a guy that just a few years ago was sitting on Wall Street advising people how to make paper millions. And everybody was applauding him. And now, in a few years, here he is, his wife supporting him with a job, $25 a week at his apartment store. And the people around Wall Street don't even want him in his office. You know what I mean? And
certainly we can see the unmanageability of Bill's life due to his alcoholism.
Okay, liquor ceased to be a luxury, became a necessity. Bathtub gin, 2 bottles a day, and often there three got to be routine. Sometimes a small deal would net me a few dollars, and I would pay my bills in the bars and delicatessen. This went on endless. I began to take an early in the morning, shaking violently. A tumblerful of gin followed by half a dozen bottles of beer would be required if I would eat my breakfast. Nevertheless, I still thought I controlled the situation. You know, and Dr. Silkworth said the alcoholic cannot differentiate the truth from the false. Here's this guy gone to hell in the handbasket. And talking about I still thought I controlled the situation. You know, this is ridiculous. We can see what has happened to him, but remember, he could not see that. And there were in the periods of sobriety which used my wife Hope, rather things got worse. The house was taken over by a mortgage hold. My mother-in-law died, and my wife and father-in-law became ill. Okay, then he got finally he got a promising business opportunity. Stocks were at their low point in 1932. I assumed I formed a group to buy. Bill, I don't know who it was, but even in his condition, you know, when you can make money for somebody, they'll still try to use you. Even in his condition, these people thought, well, they could make some money off of it. So he got this deal together, and he said, I was just as generous in the profits, and surely this man needed money. And we're talking about a pretty good sum of money here. He had put the whole deal together. He had a great mind in this. You know, Bill had a great mind in the stock business. In fact, you know, even an actor, it talks about it even after Bill got, you know, years after his years of sobriety and his involvement in AA, those people still wanted him back. There was one guy I used to always see him that was in the stock business, one of those old people that he had done, and he knew the quality of his mind for that field. And he always did. He never forgot, that Bill, even after retired, even after many, many years, he tried to get Bill back into that field because he knew he had a great mind for it. And he used to always tell Bill, if you saw him in the elevator somewhere in New York City, he said, when you get through with that A thing, come back over, you know. But he had a hell of a mind for this. And so he put this thing together, and just before some of them were sitting out that night, and they were packed, had a bottle of Applejack. You have to remember that most of Bill's drinking was during Prohibition, you know, as they went around, Bill said, oh, no, I can't drink. I got this thing, and I promise not to drink it. This is over with. And the second time the bottle came around, Bill said, oh, well, one little drink won't hurt me. And he took a little drink, and he blew this whole deal, and it vanished. And this is when he said, you know, after this, he came to the point where we all come to. And Bill, he said, I woke up. this had to be stopped. So, and we always, we talked about that last night, you know, all of us repeat our national anthem. But at one point we say, hey, you know, I can't drink. I'm never going to be any good unless I quit drinking. So he said, I'm going to just quit. I was through forever. Before, I had written a lot of sweet promises. My wife happily deserved it. This time I admit I meant business, and so I did. So he just quit. It's just shortly after I came home drunk. You know, we can identify with this. So he woes down and down. He goes on down, and over on page 6, he says, the mind and body are a marvelous mechanism. If a mind endure this agony 2 more years. He says, sometime I stole from my wife's slender purse when the morning terror and madness were on me. Again, I swayed dizzily before the open window of the medicine cabinet, where there I was poisoned and cursed myself for a week or two. And when you see other was something, you know, we talk about different drugs and alcohol. These people had the same problem. Sedatives and alcohol. There was flight from city and country and back, and my wife and I sought escape. They moved a lot. Then came the night, then the physician and physical and mental torture was so hellish I feared I would burst through my window and sash and all. Somehow I managed to drag my mattress to the lower floor, lest I suddenly meet. The doctor came with heavy sedatives. The next day found me drinking both gin and sedatives. We can see what he's doing. This combination soon landed me on the rocks. People feared for my sanity. So did I. I could eat little or nothing when drinking, and I was 40 pounds underweight. And this is really the pits of it all. This is really the physical and mental deterioration. I mean, he's at the bottom of it. Now, this is when things begin to go up for him. He says, my brother-in-law is a physician, and this was Dr. Leonard Strong. And through his kindness and that of my mother, I was placed in a nationally known hospital for the mental and physical rehabilitation of alcoholics. And he was placed in the Towns Hospital in New York, under Charlie Towns' hospital. Under the so-called belladonna treatment, my brain cleared, hydrotherapy, and mild exercise helped much. Best of all, I met a kind doctor who explained that though certain is selfish and foolish, I was seriously ill bodily and mentally. And this is when they was treated there at the Towns Hospital. And I was looking at always, I don't talk about it much, but I was looking at this thing, hydrotherapy, and Charlie and I were in a hospital, I think, in somewhere in Australia. And it was a place where it was kind of a health hospital, and they treated alcoholics and exercise and all this other stuff was there for weight loss patients and stuff. And I went into one room, and I seen something. It was a little cabinet-like room, and it had a gurney in there, and just a metal gurney, and all these things sticking out of the ceiling and shooting down toward this table, and it looked like an execution chamber or something. And I asked this guy, I said, what's that room? What are they doing there? He said, that's hydrotherapy. You know, they just put you in there and shoot you with hot water. That's what that was coming out of the water. So I could see he got a hot water bath by what it was. And that, you know, bathing drunks in hot water don't help him much. Just got a clean drunk. They did it hot water all their life anyway.
Now, of course, this is when Bill visited with Dr. Silkworth, or when Dr. Silkworth withdrew him from alcohol in the summer of 1933. Mm-hmm. He said, best of all, I met a kind doctor who explained that though certainly selfish and foolish, I'd been seriously ill bodily and mentally. Okay. The doctor explained to him his ideas about the disease of alcoholism. And Bill said it relieved me somewhat to learn that in alcoholics, the will is amazingly weakened when it comes to combating liquor. So it often remains strong in other respects. Bill was a very strong, self-willed human being, and he simply could not understand why his self-will didn't work on alcohol.
Right.
So he was relieved when the doctor explained to him the obsession of the mind. And I think most of us are. Most alcoholics are strong-willed people.
Right.
People tell us our problem is we don't have enough willpower. No, our problem is we got too damn much willpower. You know, weak-willed people do not become alcoholics. Weak-willed people, the third time they puke, they quit drinking. And the alcoholic says there must be some way to drink without puking. And we keep trying it. He said, understanding myself now, I fared forth in high hope. For 3 or 4 months, the goose hung high. I went to town regularly and even made a little money. Surely this was the answer, self-knowledge. But it was not. For the frightful day came when I drank once more. His mind told him it'd be okay to drink. He took a drink, triggered the allergy, and couldn't stop. The curve of my declining moral and bodily health fell off like a ski jump. After a time, I returned to the hospital like 1 year later, the summer of 1934. This was the finish, the curtain, it seemed to me. My weary and despairing wife was informed that it would all end with heart failure during DTs, or I would develop a wet brain perhaps within a year. She would soon have to give me over to the undertaker or the asylum. And Bill said they did not need to tell me I knew, and almost welcomed the idea. It was a devastating blow to my pride. I had thought so well of myself and of my abilities that my capacity to surmount obstacles was cornered at last. Now I was to plunge into the dark, joining that endless procession of sots who had gone on before. I thought of my poor wife. There had been much happiness after all. What would I not give to make amends, but that was over now. No words can tell of the loneliness and despair I found in that bitter morass of self-pity. Quicksand stretched around me in all directions. I had met my match. I had been overwhelmed. Alcohol was my master.
Look, in this last paragraph is where Bill took step one. This is where Bill admitted that he was powerless over alcohol and his life had become unmanageable. Well, any step one really hadn't been formally written, but we can see the concept of what the same thought is, the same concept is right there. No words can tell the loneliness. I never see anything more beautiful description than step one. No words can tell the loneliness and despair I found in the bitter morass of self-pity. Quicksand stretched around me in all directions. I had met my match. I had been overwhelmed. Alcohol was my master. That's a beautiful description, the most beautiful thing I've ever read. It puts it in the perspective, total defeat, total surrender. Okay, now, today, if you and I, thank God, you know, if you and I ever come to that point in our life, or any alcoholic here, you know, in the world today, who would come to that state of mind and realize he's totally defeated in the... The next thing will come to his mind today, hey, I better go to Alcoholics Anonymous. But remember, at this time, Bill didn't have anywhere to go. I mean, he took step one with no alternative. And, you know, we have to realize what this guy was going through. He wasn't nowhere he could go. There was nothing he could do, and he was totally defeated. And he was this away for a few months. He said, trembling, and he left the hospital. Trembling, I stepped from the hospital, a broken man, and he was. Fear sobered me a bit. You know, just the fear, the fear of that. And then came the insidious insanity of the first drink on Armistice Day in 1934. And this is November 11th. This was the summer of 1934. So he stays through the summer, through the rest of the summer and the fall. And on Armistice Day, he takes another drink. And then this is the beginning of the last drunk before he ends up, you know, with Evie making the visit to him.
He said, near the end of that bleak November, I sat drinking in my kitchen. Now, remember, he'd started on November the 11th. Triggered the allergy, couldn't stop. With a certain satisfaction, I reflected there was enough gin concealed about the house to carry me through that night to the next day. My wife was at work. I wondered whether I dared add a full bottle of gin to the head of her bed. I would need it before daylight. My musing was interrupted by the telephone. The cheery voice of an old school friend asked if he might come over. He was sober. It was years since I could remember his coming to New York in that condition. And, of course, we know this to be a fellow named Eddie Thatcher.
Okay. He said, I was amazed. Rumor had he been committed for alcoholic insanity. I wondered how he had escaped. Now, you know, there's a story that Ebby tells a story, too, that Ebby, had been
his father had seen his father die, and they had a summer, the family had a summer home. Eddie was called his child. You know, he was a drunk. He was kind of a black sheep of the family clan. And he came from a prominent family. And you know how a drunk is. He kind of isolates himself from the family. He's tired of fooling with him. And after his father died, they had given Ebby to some, this little summer home up there, and he was living in it. And he had set it on fire a couple of times. And the neighbors had complained, and they had also given Ebby the old one of his father's cars. And it seemed like Ebby had been driving the car down the road one day, and Ebby ran off the road drunk and hit a lady's house. Now, that would have been all right, but he happened to hit the kitchen. In fact, he didn't hit the kitchen. He went in the kitchen. In fact, the lady happened to be in the kitchen when the car came in there. And they said, Eddie got out of the car, bowed his hat, and said, "Morning, morning, madam. It will be as a nice morning for a cup of coffee." And it seemed like some narrow-minded judge without a sense of humor wanted to put Eddie in the nut house. So here was the predicament Eddie was in when Roland heard about it. Roland has it, and he sent two guys down on a Friday to see about him. And that Monday, Roland and two other guys showed up in court, and the judge turned. They said they would like to help Eddie. And Roland told about his experience, and the judge let Roland have Ebby. He took him to his home and kept him a couple of weeks. Then he took him into New York City to Sam Shoemaker's mission. And there at the mission, which was basically the headquarters of the Oxford Group, the Oxford Group people there, they had about 10 or 12 people from the Oxford, who were Oxford Group members, and they worked at the mission. What they were doing, they were there working with other alcoholics who came in off the street, the street people at night, and they would feed them, and they were trying to get sober working with other people. So they put Ebby was with these people. Ebby was one of the disciples of these 12 Oxford groupers who were working at the mission with other people. And Ebby hung around Wall Street doing his time in and out. He was kind of a speculator too. And Ebby, he did some things down there. So Eddie, one day, they always worked at night at the mission, and in during the daytime, they didn't really have a lot to do. So one day, Eddie thought he would walk back down on Wall Street and see what was going on, and he got down there and he started talking to some people, and he heard they told him about Bill and what had happened to Bill over the years. And he said, "I believe I'll go over and see him and see if he's interested in this thing I'm involved in." So this is when Ebby went to see Bill. He says, "You know, I wondered how he escaped. Of course he would have dinner and I could drink open with him. Unmindfully of his welfare, I thought only about recapturing the spirit of the day. There was a time we had chartered an airplane to complete a jag." And you know, one time this is a story in itself about how him and Bill was drinking one night, and they met a drunk pilot. And this pilot said he was going to Vermont. And